أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. فلما فصل طالوت بالجنود قال إن الله مبتليكم بنهر فمن شرب منه فليس مني ومن لم يطعمه فإنه مني إلا من اغترف غرفة بيده فشربوا منه إلا قليلا منهم فلما جاوزه هو والذين آمنوا معه قالوا لا طاقة لنا اليوم بجالوت وجنوده قال الذين يظنون أنهم ملاقوا الله كم من فئة قليلة غلبت فئة كثيرة بإذن الله والله مع الصابرين. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. فالحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. ثم أما بعد. The story continues. فلما فصل طالوت بالجنود, when the armies crossed over with when طالوت crossed over along with the armies. So now طالوت has been appointed. He is the general. He is the commander in chief. الفصل in Arabic بنا ما بين شيئين, a gap between two things. So it's basically crossing over a river, a valley, whatever it may be. قال إن الله مبتليكم بنهر, that certainly Allah has already decreed a test for you by way of a river. مبتليكم, the إضافة, interestingly, in the for those of you that are Arabic students, مبتليكم, because it's an إضافة, it can actually carry the meaning of something that is a done deal. So قاتلون رجلاً is different from قاتلوا رجلاً. قاتلون رجلاً, somebody is going to kill someone. قاتلوا رجلاً, someone's already killed someone. Because of the idafa, it's already a done deal. So Allah has decreed, it's done deal, guaranteed it's going to happen, that He's going to be testing you by way of a river. فَمَنْ شَرِبَ مِنْهُ فَلَيْسَ مِنِّي, and whoever would drink from it, is not, it doesn't belong to me. وَمَنْ لَمْ يَطْعَمْهُ, and whoever doesn't consume any of it, notice the word ta'am, how do you drink a river, or eat a river? The idea is, I just said, whoever drinks from it, disqualified from my army. And I'll explain why he said that. But the next phrase that's coupled with it is, whoever doesn't consume it, eat it. يَطْعَمْهُ, whoever doesn't consume it as food, is from me. Meaning, just because I said don't drink from it, doesn't mean you can go fishing. And then when you're barbecuing the fish, you're like, you never said anything about eating, you just said drinking. So he covered drinking and eating, because the only source of food was going to be the river, by shariba and lam yata'am. Okay, both are now covered. By the way, if you used one of them and not the other, they would have found a way to do the other. So, man lam yata'am, okay, then you can drink. Man lam yashrab, then you can eat. So, both of them are captured. There's no redundancy here. It's actually capturing the full scope of what the Bible called the fast. Now, remember what Jonathan did. Jonathan, instead of fasting, broke the fast, had food, went out and fought, gained victories, proved that Saul was wrong, and this whole fasting instruction was wrong. This is actually divine instruction from Allah. But why is it there? Why is an army being told to fast? You see, in the discipline of an army, there are multiple, you know, aspects. When the general or the commander tells you to go, you have to go. When the general or commander tells you you have to stop or retreat, you immediately have to stop and retreat. Nobody can make individual decisions as an army. You have to actually follow instructions to the T. And sometimes the right decision is to fall back. And it's not, doesn't mean you have a retreat. It means you need to regroup, you need to come from a different angle, whatever strategies the general decides. But if everybody's doing their own thing, then that army will be ripped apart in no time. They need to internalize collective discipline as an army, as a military. And their military training, because this army's been put together rather quickly, the enemy is approaching, he's had no time to train them in their discipline. He says, look, Allah has divinely decreed military training for you by way of this river. Okay? Because military training is necessary for an army to survive in battle, and they haven't had the time to do this under his command, so this is going to be their test. And now the thing is, the test is, there's water in front of you, you've been traveling, you're thirsty, you need to drink, You're hungry. There are fish right there jumping out of the water. You can just catch them and eat. You're not going to touch any of it. This is actually a special, not only is this a discipline of restraint, holding yourself back, you know, how loyal are you to your leader, how much grit and toughness do you have, but there's another part of this. Let me explain this to you by way of the example of the Battle of Uhud. In Uhud, the archers are in a strategically advantageous position. And the spoils of war, the enemy has already run. The spoils of war are sitting there on the ground waiting to be taken. The Prophet ﷺ has given instructions, don't come down from there. Under any circumstance, basically. And they assume, well, that means under loss, don't come down. But under victory, we should be able to go. And this is victory, we should be able to go. No, sometimes even marching forward when things are convenient and easy can also mean death. So you can't just pull back when your general tells you. You can also, when your general says to you, don't shoot, don't fire, don't move forward. Until he says you can, you should not, no matter how opportune you think it is, no matter how strategically advantageous you think it is, it needs to be a collective decision made by the head of the army. And so that's why this discipline exercise was given to them, of the many reasons. Of course, it's a spiritual test also. By the way, right before their battle, they had to fast. Yes? Right before the first battle of Islam, Badr, which happened on the 27th of Ramadan, what were the Muslims doing? Fasting. Look at the parallels. So epic. And whoever drinks from it is not from me, and whoever doesn't consume from it belongs to me. This is my ummah. SubhanAllah. إِلَّا مَنْ اِغْتَرَفَ غُرْفَةً بِيَدِهِ. Then he made the exception. Except the one who takes a sip enough to hold within his hand. الْغُرْفَةُ حَبْلٌ مَعْقُودٌ يُلْقَى فِي عُنُقِ الْبَعِيرِ. The knot of that's put in the neck of a camel is also called a غُرْفَة. غُرْفَة also means this much. This much. You're going through a river and you just, that's it. That's all you took. غُرْفَةً بِيَدِهِ. فَشَرِبُوا مِنْهُ. But then they drank from it, meaning they didn't just sip from it, they went swimming and like they went all out. Okay? Illa qalilam minhum, except very, very, very few from among them. Notice here the mansub of qalilan. It's actually, in a sense, a ma'tuf on the hum inside sharibu for grammar students. But this istithna, some say the nasab of it is standard. It's supposed to be that way. Others say, no, this is actually to separate this qalil from that first group. Okay? So it basically, فَشَرِبُوا مِنْهُ إِلَّا لَمْ يَشْرَبْ قَلِيلٌ مِنْهُمْ is the ta'wil of it, the taqdeer of it. But it's qalilan to separate this group from the previous group. Let me put that in simple English now. They drank from it, except a few who were nothing like the ones who drank. But those were very, very few. Minhum, from among them. فَلَمَّا جَاوَزَهُ هُوَ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مَعَهُ. Then when he crossed over it, meaning the river, he himself crossed it over, meaning he was the first one to demonstrate what it means to cross the river and not take from the water. He's thirsty also. He's hungry also. But he demonstrated by example. And then those who came along with him, when they all crossed it over, they then declared, meaning the ones that had drunk a lot of water, the ones that were kind of, they weren't able to follow the discipline. This, as a result of it, as a result of that disobedience, what Allah put was fear inside of their hearts. Allowed that fear to foster. And so they declared, لَا طَاقَةَ لَنَا الْيَوْمَ بِجَالُوتَ وَجُنُودِهِ. We have no power today. We have no capability today. We have no strength today to stand before Goliath, Jalut, and his army. And his armies. Because as they cross the water, now they're approaching a valley. Basically, the way the Bible describes this battle is it takes place in a valley. They're on this side of the mountain, the enemy's on that side of the mountain, and there's a dip at the bottom. Whoever goes down first is gonna get shot at. So they're both kinda just standing there staring at each other. It's too far to shoot. They're just staring each other down. But these are a few, and there's a massive army basically appearing right before them, and it's overpowering them. And they're like, there's no way we can face Jalut and his armies. قَالَ الَّذِينَ يَظُنُّونَ أَنَّهُمْ مُلَاقُ اللَّهِ. Those who were absolutely convinced that they are absolutely going to be meeting with Allah. They're not meeting the enemy, they're meeting with Allah. This is actually interesting because even in the Quran, in the Battle of Uhud, Allah describes, سَابِقُوا إِلَى مَغْفِرَةٍ مِّن رَبِّكُمْ. Run to forgiveness from your master. You're not running to the enemy. You're running to forgiveness. So now they are convinced we're not going to be meeting the enemy. We're actually, we have no fear because that's actually, if the enemy kills us, we're just meeting Allah. Those who were truly convinced of that, they declared, كَمْ مِنْ فِئَةٍ قَلِيلَةٍ غَلَبَتْ فِئَةً كَثِيرَةً. How many times has it been that a small group has been able to overpower a large one? By Allah's permission, بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. That only happens when Allah gives leave. This is exactly what happened in Badr, isn't it? So you see why these parallels are important. You see why right before this story was قَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلَ. You fight in the path of Allah. Muslims, fight in the path of Allah. And then this story was given. وَاللَّهُ مَعَ الصَّابِرِينَ. And Allah is with those who have sabr. Somebody ever wonder, this is a story of Banu Israel, right? In the first half of Baqarah, there's a long story of Banu Israel. Why not just put this there? You can't put this there. Because that's all criticism. This is praise for Banu Israel. This is among them those who did the right thing despite the nifaq elements among them, the hypocrisy among them. This doesn't belong in that discussion. This is a separate discussion altogether. So it's not mixed or muddled with that piece of revelation. وَلَمَّا بَرَزُوا. So they said, you know, how many times has it been that a small group has overpowered a large one by Allah's permission? And Allah is certainly with those who persevere, who can stand tall. مَعَ الصَّابِرِينَ. وَلَمَّا بَرَزُوا لِجَالُوتَ وَجُنُودِهِ. And when finally, when eventually, they came face to face with Goliath and his armies. قَالُوا. Now they're face to face. Goliath is basically one of their biggest warriors. He's massive, big and tall also. He used to wear all bronze armor. Heavy kachink kachink armor. He had like a sword in one, a massive axe-like sword in one hand. He had one of those swinging javelin things in the other hand. He had massive like spears hooked onto his back, and his face was completely covered with a bronze mask and fully armored. The only thing you could see is his eyes, and he comes down from the mountain and he stands in the bottom of the valley and he calls out to all the Israelites, "Who will fight me?" And his army behind him is rooting him on. "Who will fight me?" And when this happens, the Qur'an doesn't give us details. Here's where we go to the Bible for some details that they don't conflict the Qur'an's narrative, they actually prove the Qur'an's narrative. So we accept those details. What are they? What happened was, Dawood alayhi salam, David had a few brothers in the army. David was a kid, and he had a few brothers in the army. And his job, the only reason they brought him along, he's going to run and fetch water for them. That's what his job was. When, you know, Goliath came down, Jalut came down and made this call to the Muslim army, he was actually sent to fetch water. And he heard his call, and he got upset, and nobody was coming down, so the kid that fetches water, and otherwise herds sheep, walked down. And said, "I'll fight you." And so now one of he's not even a soldier. And he stands down there, and faces off against the biggest warrior they have, standing in front of him. So everybody's in shock. They're like, "This kid is going to get killed. What has he done? He's going to humiliate us, etc., etc." Because they were preparing who among us is going to go. And while that discussion is still happening, and Saul is trying to convince some to grow a spine and go get down there, Dawood is already there. And he's not even very old yet. But he was very good with the sling. And the sling, I actually did a study on this. The sling was actually used very skillfully in ancient times. Basically, you have the string and a rock goes inside it. You spin it very, very, very fast and you release. Right? But this became such precise a weapon that people used to actually shoot flying birds in the air with them. And this was actually the closest thing to like a gun that they had. Interestingly enough, because this is Jewish history, right? I'll tell you what his name is. Baruch Halpern, a historian. He actually studied this, and there's another one, actually, I want to share with you his name. Really cool. Okay, I'll find his name. I'll find his name later. He's a ballistics expert from the Israeli military, who spent time just studying the effect of the sling. Because they take pride in this because this is Jewish history. So he actually does tests on the sling and shooting it, and actually says this is no different from a 35 millimeter. Like the speed of the rock is no different than a bullet. It's crazy. You know? And it can pierce, you know, bone or whatever. It'll shoot you. It'll kill you. So now, having understood this, there's another dimension of this from a military strategy point of view that I'd like you to understand. In ancient war, there are three kinds of soldiers. There's your foot soldiers. There's your cavalry. There's soldiers on horses. Horses, elephants, camels, whatever, but horses most of the time. And there are your projectile warriors. These, you need all three. The horses that are coming, when the horses are running, the foot soldiers are holding the spear that goes right into the horse. So the foot soldiers, their best offense is against the cavalry. The cavalry, and the best attack against the foot soldiers are the projectile warriors who can shoot spears, arrows, bullets, whatever it is, from a distance. Because if the foot soldiers get close, it's hand-to-hand combat. Right? Then it's too late. And also the foot soldiers move slower, so they're an easier target. The cavalry moves too fast, so the soldiers with the guns and the projectile weapons can't get to them. So each one of them trumps the other, you understand? And if you don't, for example, the cavalry is let loose, then they're gonna go so fast, they're gonna run over the projectile warriors. That's why you need the foot soldiers in the middle. But the foot soldiers are also not, they're basically defenseless against the projectile warriors. So there's this trumping of each over the other. Now what I need you to understand is when Dawood entered into the battlefield, it wasn't just Iman in Allah, yeah, I'm gonna destroy him. Like, no, it wasn't like that. What kind of warrior is Goliath? What did I describe him as? An axe, heavy weapon, massive armor. He's a foot soldier. What is, you know, Dawood alayhi salam, what kind of warrior is he? Projectile. You're basically bringing a gun to a knife fight. You see? You, from a military strategic point of view, Dawood alayhi salam is already at an advantage. If he's a good shot. He can't miss, because everything's covered in bronze. The only thing open is his, right here, this piece right here. That's the only thing open. In one, you know, account of the Bible, he actually asked his brother if he can go down and fight him, because he's so good, he can knock the tooth out of a wolf when it looks at his sheep. That's how good he is with the weapon, right? So he comes down. Goliath is going to be slow to move, easy target. He's going to, you know, ka-chink, ka-chink towards him. In the meantime, he does a slink. By the way, from a distance, everybody's up on top of the mountain. Do they see even the slink? They don't see it. It's so small. So he shoots it. It goes right between his eyes. It goes inside his skull. And he's just standing there, and he's only hovering there in the air. Because, you know, like, it's his massive armor is holding him up. Otherwise he's dead. And nobody realizes that he's dead. But he's just standing there. And so what Dawood does is, he runs over and jumps on him. And when he jumps on him, because he's dead, what happens to him? He falls down, takes his mask off and slays him. And the crowd thinks that this just happened, you know, hand to hand. And the Israelite army, the army of the Muslims, are like, whoa! You know, they will go crazy. And the other army is like, what? Now here's the other thing. A lot of times soldiers come into the battlefield not because they believe in the cause. Soldiers come into the battlefield because they were forced. And a lot of times soldiers that don't believe in a cause, if they believe in a cause, if they're the only one on the battlefield, they don't care. But if they don't believe in a cause, then the only reason they are on the battlefield is because they say, if anything goes wrong, at least my brother next to me, my brother in arms, will protect me. I'm just there for my fellow brother in arms, and he's there for me. And when he sees 1,000 soldiers next to him, he feels like, okay, we're gonna be alright. When the strongest one of them falls, then each one of them in their head falls like dominoes. In their head, they're like, the guy next to me is not gonna be able to help. If that guy couldn't stand one of their kids, this guy next to me is useless. And then comes the noise that is being made from the opposing end. You see? So this scene needs to be understood. But before this scene happened, the way this played out, nobody knew it's going to play out this way. The Israelites were clearly at a disadvantage. And now there's a kid standing in front of a giant that he's supposedly going to fight. So what did they say? قَالُوا رَبَّنَا أَفْرِغْ عَلَيْنَا صَبْرًا وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا. Master, pour perseverance, patience, constancy, you know, over us. أَفْرِغْ actually means like a bucket poured on you. Like we're so weak right now, we want to run. Drench us in strength, drench us in grit and perseverance. And plant our feet firm. ثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا. Firm our feet up. Why? Because it's the time to turn your heels and run. Keep us strong. Don't let us retreat now. وَانْصُرْنَا عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الْكَافِرِينَ. Aid us against the disbelieving nation. Surah Al-Baqarah will end also. وَانْصُرْنَا عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الْكَافِرِينَ. Right? And this is actually similar to the dua that is made at the battle, reminding us of the battle of Badr, in the battle of Uhud, in Surah Al-Imran. Okay? وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا وَانْصُرْنَا عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الْكَافِرِينَ occurs there again. Okay? So this is again an echo, something that was said thousands of years ago is now going to be repeated by the Muslims on the Battle of Badr. The same dua, it's the same Allah that they're serving. It's the same cause that they're serving. And the same, you know, insurmountable odds that they're standing against. فَهَزَمُوهُمْ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. What a word to use by Allah. هَزَمُوهُمْ. هَزَمَا in Arabic is the low purring of a cat. When a cat does, I don't know how to do it. That's called hazm, actually. Basically, they made cats out of them. They made scaredy cats out of them, literally. They annihilated them. They dissipated them. They destroyed their morale. They weakened them from within. All of this is inside. فَهَزَمُوهُمْ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ by Allah's permission alone. وَقَتَلَ دَاوُدُ جَالُوتُ while Dawood killed Jalut. وَآتَاهُ اللَّهُ الْمُلْكُ وَعَلَّمَهُ بِالْحِكْمَةِ. And Allah gave him kingdom. I'll explain this tomorrow, inshallah, in detail. But this ayah is actually one of the most incredible places in the Quran on the subject. You can call the subject brevity in history. Brevity in capturing history. In other words, there are several chapters of Jewish history. Each chapter captured by one phrase inside this ayah. فَهَزَمُوهُمْ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ is the nature of the rest of the battle. The pivotal turning point in the battle, وَقَتَلَ دَاوُدُ جَالُوتَ. Then, what comes after the battle is the rise of David as a hero among the Israelites, and when he's old enough, he's the one appointed king, وَآتَاهُ اللَّهُ الْمُلْكُ. When he's appointed king, as he matures in his career, Allah teaches him how to pass judgment. وَالْحِكْمَةِ. He becomes a judge among people. And people bring difficult disputes and cases to him. That's wal-hikmah. Then Allah revealed to him the ways of developing armor, like had never been made before. Allah taught him how to speak to birds. The mountains would sing along with him. وَعَلَّمَهُ مِمَّا يَشَاءُ. And he taught him from whatever he desired. These are each long, profound chapters of Jewish history. Each one of them. And we'll look at each of them, inshallah, a little bit tomorrow. وَلَوْلَا, and then the principle. وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضُ. That's scary. That's just scary. Had it not been for Allah pushing one people out by means of another people. Had it not been that throughout human history, Allah takes one group of people and gives them strength so they can push out another group of people. If that didn't happen, لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضُ. The earth itself would have become corrupt. Dynasties will rise and they will fall. Empires will rise and they will fall. Nations will rise and they will fall. And it doesn't even matter if they're Muslim or not. That is the way of the world according to Allah. Just like a person has a life and then they die, nations, governments, empires, they have a life and then they die. And Allah made this the way of the world, because if it wasn't the way of the world, the entire world would have been corrupted. This is the way of Allah, this is the way by which Allah cleanses the world. Now you can look at it in two ways, and I'd like to highlight those two ways for you. You can look at it in the way of Muslim nations and non-Muslim nations. Believing nations, like the Israelites, believing nations, you would think, imagine Allah gave them power, they should keep power. Right? Because if Allah gave the believers power, then why give it to the kuffar again? Just keep it with them. Isn't that a good thing? Isn't that the goal? Clearly that's not the goal of Allah's design of history. That even Muslims should keep power. Why? Because even when Muslims become powerful, then enough of them start becoming ungrateful and start taking control for granted and forget that the earth belongs to Allah and their humility starts going away and they become worldly in nature and they start assuming that they have a right to rule the earth. And all of this is an antithesis to the humility and gratitude that they're supposed to have. And when enough of that happens and a corruption comes within them, then they no longer represent the teachings of Allah. They are no longer ambassadors of Iman. And when they're weak enough, then Allah says, no, you don't deserve this anymore. This is not good. If you remain in power, you will give Islam itself a bad name. Because people will look at you and think, this is what Islam looks like. This is not what Islam looks like. This is people, groups of people fighting each other, corruption in the name of Islam. You know, politicians that artificially use Allah's name and His book. That's not going to stand. I'm going to replace you by people who don't believe. He did that with the Israelites, didn't he? And then the believers will make tawbah. They'll come back, they'll realize why they lost the favor of Allah. And they'll repent. And they'll see the corruption at the hands of disbelievers. But they'll say, if we're going to fight against their corruption, we can't be corrupt ourselves and then say we're fighting against their corruption. We have to look in the mirror first. Until we become morally superior, we are in no position to take over the reins of the earth. So then they'll cleanse themselves, and when they cleanse themselves, when they truly become people of Iman, أَنْتُمُ الْأَعْلَوْنِ إِن كُنْتُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ, you'll be superior, you'll be the most supreme. If in fact you believe, Allah will give them control again, power again, stability again. And then, what does He say Himself? وَعَدَ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مِنْكُمْ وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَيَسْتَخْلِفَنَّهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ. He will give them khilafah in the land, He will leave them behind in the land, He will stabilize the land for them. وَلَيُمَكِّنَنَّهُمْ دِينَهُمُ الَّذِي ارْتَضَى لَهُمْ. He will stabilize for them the religion that He was happy with for them. When will He do this? يَعْبُدُونَنِي وَلَا يُشْرِكُونَ بِي شَيْئًا. When they truly worship Me and don't do any shirk with Me. When they do that, I will promise them, I'll give them. But until then, they don't deserve it because they'll make more corruption. Sometimes, wallahi al-azim, we complain, why don't the Muslims have power? Why do the kuffar have power? And sometimes I travel to the Muslim lands. I travel to Muslim countries. And with very few exceptions, I thank Allah, Muslims don't have power over the earth. Because the way we are, if some of our governments were in charge of the United States, you wouldn't live here. You wouldn't live here. Many Muslims leave the land that they're in because of the overwhelming corruption at the hands of Muslims. And then we argue Muslims should have power. Muslims should have integrity first. And power belongs to Allah, and He gives it to those, even though nobody's perfect, you will find Allah will hand power to those who have relatively more integrity than others. And then when their integrity starts falling, it means this time has come for Allah to replace them with someone else. And then their integrity falls, and someone else. And their integrity falls, and someone else. This is the formula Allah gave in the Quran, and it's not even about believers and disbelievers. We think it's about believers and disbelievers. Allah says, وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ. Not الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا بِالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا بِالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا. No, people with people. That's how it's gonna be. And if it wasn't that case, لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضِ, the entire earth would have been corrupted. وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ ذُو فَضْلٍ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ. What a beautiful conclusion. However, no, Allah possesses great favor over all nations, all peoples, all religions, all ethnicities, all countries, all villages, all cities, all continents. Allah wants good for all of them. The notion that, you know, Allah only wants good for the Muslims. Allah only wants rule and peace and security and stability for the Muslims. Everybody else, Allah curses. I don't know what Quran you're reading. I don't know what book you're reading. That is not Allah's book. Allah Azza wa Jalla wants to bestow His favor and goodness upon all nations. There's a reason Allah mentions, for example, the Queen Sheba, Saba. And the civil conversation she's having among her generals. She's not even a believer. But do they have elements of goodness in them? They do when Allah acknowledges it. Allah acknowledges the good in their government. He doesn't just declare them kuffar and disbelievers and worthy of death and destruction. No. He actually acknowledges what's going on within them. And that they have good in them. This is the way of Allah Azza wa Jal. So, the more you study Quran, you realize that Allah Azza wa Jal has made His mercy and His deen and His blessings on the world broad. And we, because of our insecurity, like to restrict it to, just ourselves. From the very beginning, we read, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. The word Al-Alameen does not exclude any nation, any religion, any group. All people. And there, it's fine. He's their master. They should come in submission to him. Here, لَذُو فَضْلٍ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ. He possesses great favor over all peoples. And fadl, actually, the nakira over here, instead of saying ذُو الْفَضْلِ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ, the nakira here, you know what it suggests? It suggests تَنَوَّر. Allah will give some nation some favor, another nation another favor, another nation another favor. He will make some of them extremely creative. Some of them He'll give amazing human resources. Some of them natural resources. Some of them incredible intelligence. Some of them amazing ability to do trade. They'll give different nations different talents, different strengths, different benefits. And even then, within them, when one group takes too much power and becomes corrupt, Allah will replace them with another. And then with another, and then with another. This is the nature of things with Allah. That's the way history is supposed to play out. So that's the, in summary, the beautiful, beautiful story of Talut and Jalut. Inshallah ta'ala, on this last ayah, which is a pretty long ayah, 250, I'm going to go a little bit further tomorrow, inshallah, because I would like you to appreciate, some of the nuances inside of it, and then bi'idhnillah, we'll move forward. Barakallahu li wa lakum fil Qur'an al-Hakim, wa nafa'ani wa iyyakum bil ayat wa dhikr al-Hakim.